solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
People coming in from other backgrounds into politics also need to understand that it can be quite a different universe altogether. It can be sometimes Alice in Wonderland, because the normal logic that works in the corporate world, for instance, doesn't work in politics. Politics is about popularity, not necessarily about the logic of certain actions. Politics is about getting the maximum number of people to vote for you. And how you achieve that can sometimes take very different paths than would appear rational to many professionals.
Welcome to the fifth conversation in 2018 and the 26th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations with accomplished individuals across various fields on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and organizations and help them play to their potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition, personal and organizational. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. If you're new to the podcast and want to get a sense of the nature of content that's covered, you might want to go to YouTube and type Play to Potential Highlights from 2017. I've tried to capture the key takeaways from my various conversations last year with leaders across disciplines, from people such as Amish Tripathi, Zia Modi, Nandan Nilekani, Vishy Anand, Vijay Amritraj, Avnish Bajaj, Vinita Bali, and the like. My guest this time is Jay Panda, who is an Indian politician and currently serving as a member of the Lok Sabha and is elected from the Kendrapara constituency in Odisha. He's currently serving his fourth term as a member of parliament and was a member of Rajya Sabha between 2000 and 2009. Jay is a graduate of Michigan Technological University and was involved in the world of business for several years before he joined politics. In our conversation, we spoke about how people should think about politics as a career, what are the intrinsic traits or characteristics people should have to succeed, how he thinks about staying relevant over time with the advent of technology, what the world of business leadership can learn from politics, and more. Without further ado, over to the conversation with Jay.
Jay, excited to be talking to you. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And why don't I dive straight ahead? The first piece I wanted to talk to you about, Jay, was about the transition into politics. People come from all kinds of spaces. But in your instance, you were running a family business before you moved to politics. And I come across quite a few leaders who are keen to make a difference, and they consider politics as a career option, given the scale of impact that's possible. So talk to us a little bit about how should people evaluate politics as a career option as against other means of driving impact?
Well, politics is certainly one of the most important platforms for bringing about change. It has a grip over the levers of policymaking, unlike any other career. But that doesn't mean it's the only way. There are people who have made immense changes for the good of society by being in business, by being in technology, by being in social activism, and many other fields. But clearly, politics has a very direct role to play in bringing about change. Now, having said that, I believe our politics both gets too much of a bad name, and also by people looking at it as a career, not enough analysis and scrutiny of how it can or cannot be a career option. So in the sense that it gets too much of a bad name, it's because we hear about so many scandals, such misbehavior by people in politics, and a lot of that is true. But much of that, my experience, is systemic. We have inherited a system, although it is a real democracy, we have real elections, But many aspects of true democracy have not yet evolved because we simply copied the pre-independence British Raj system of parliament and governance, which does not have the same numbers of checks and balances that most other democracies have. So this is one of my passions. I've been arguing for these reforms to happen so that we have more checks and balances. We have more transparency in politics. But when people are evaluating politics as a career, some people see in it glamour. Some people see in it power. Sadly, some see in it as a way of earning. So you have to be clear what you are, where you are coming from. And if you are interested in genuinely changing society, politics can be a wonderful platform to do that, as long as you evaluate it warts and all. You don't just see it through rose-tinted glasses. You have to see both the tremendous opportunity for doing good as well as all the pitfalls and the shortcomings of the system before making that plunge.
Very interesting. Let's double-click on that. Maybe more specifically, what are the questions people should ask before taking the plunge, specifically around the pitfalls? In a way, the upsides probably are a little more visible than the downsides. So talk to us a little bit about what's the process of reflection and inquiry that an individual should go through before they say, maybe this is a place where I could have a career.
Well, let's keep in mind that most politicians in our democracy, even today, either come into politics through family connections or through student politics, right? From college days, many people are involved in politics, demonstrations, strikes, college elections, and they get into adult politics through that means. Now, I presume you're talking about somebody who's not coming from that background,
right?
But somebody who may be a professional or maybe simply a concerned citizen,
right?
Somebody who wants to bring about change. The single biggest thing I would point out is to have clarity on how you're going to fund yourself. Now, I have been fortunate that I had a career which, or I had a family background, which enabled me to get into politics without having to rely on politics to make a living. Now, if you're going to rely on politics to make a living, then you have to look at the landscape and realize that one of the biggest shortcomings in our democracy is that political funding is not transparent. Now, I mentioned to you about my passion for reform, and I have written extensively about this aspect, about how we can and how we must reform political funding, because unless that is done, politics will never be able to attract the truly decent people, and that remains a problem. Now, I would very much encourage professionals, especially who have ensured or assured their livelihood separately from politics, to consider politics as an option. Because then you don't have to dirty your fingers or get into the non-transparent world of political funding. So this is a crucial question, and this sort of eliminates a lot of viable people, because young professionals obviously would not have yet established their financial security. So one of the aspects I have argued for is state funding, matching funds, and also an emphasis on focusing on the legitimacy and tax-paid nature of political funds. So this is not the forum to go into details of my proposals for political funding reform. But if some of those reforms were in fact to take place over the medium term, then it would be even possible for younger professionals who don't yet have full financial security for the rest of their lives to get into politics. And that's why I'm such a big advocate of that.
Got it. But let's say for a minute, an individual has crossed that financial hurdle and that's taken care of. What are the additional, let's say, mental stage gates that people should have for them to say, yeah, maybe I could be relevant here?
Well, there are many. I only pointed out the financial security aspect because it is the single biggest hurdle to getting good, talented, well-intentioned citizens into politics. Now, people coming in from other backgrounds into politics also need to understand that it can be quite a different universe altogether. It can be sometimes Alice in Wonderland, because the normal logic that works in the corporate world, for instance, doesn't work in politics. Politics is about popularity, not necessarily about the logic of certain actions. Politics is about getting the maximum number of people to vote for you, and how you achieve that can sometimes take very different paths than would appear rational to many professionals. Another thing I would point out is you need to develop a very thick skin, because in politics, throwing mud and allegations is part of the daily discourse. So don't be surprised if you're under attack just for saying rational, logical things that are in the national interest. People will attribute motives to you even if you have none.
Got it. And one of the themes I'm curious about when I look at transitions, especially when people move from one domain to another, is if there are themes around derailments that happen. Again, if you sort of looked at the graveyard of people that enter politics from, let's say, the sort of professional context, are there, you spoke about the financial hurdle, but for a minute, if we go beyond that, are there themes around why people fail when they come in? Which element of the politics do they not get when they come in?
I think the element that a lot of people don't get is that politics doesn't work on the same rationale as it might in a professional setting. Now, if you're coming from a business world, despite your internal corporate politics, despite ego hassles, despite strategies working or not working, everybody has a shared goal of some kind. And in politics, that's not necessarily the case. You would imagine that politicians across the spectrum have a shared goal that whatever is for the national good, we should accept. But that's not politics. Whereas in a company, although companies also have shortcomings, of course, but the shareholders' interest drives the rationale of the company. So whatever is going to yield to company's success will largely have a strong role to play in decision making. In politics, the very same ideas that you may have championed in government, you will find the same people opposing those ideas when they are in opposition, not because somehow it has become bad for the country, but because they want it to happen on their watch. Somebody else doesn't take the credit. And the opposite also happens. People who have opposed ideas when they were in opposition, when they come to government, suddenly take the position that it's good for the country and they should go ahead and do it. So this kind of logic doesn't really prevail in many professional settings.
Very interesting. And if you translate that to sort of the traits and characteristics of people to succeed, again, I used to be a search consultant in the past, and we'd start with what does the business want and therefore what should we look for in the leader. So therefore, if you look at intrinsic traits and characteristics, what are the kind of traits and characteristics people should look for within themselves for them to say, maybe I could flourish in that sort of a fuzzy context?
So here some things will be in common with other professions, but some things will not. So again, let me point out, one of the biggest attributes anybody will require in politics is a thick skin. Now, in other fields, you may not need to have such thick a skin, but in politics, you do need. And another aspect, which is different, which is common across professions, including politics and other professions, is sheer perseverance. You can see examples in politics of people who have been wiped out and have hung in there and later on made a comeback. So sheer perseverance is extremely important in politics. Another thing that's very, very important is street smartness. To be shrewd, to understand people, to have EQ, emotional quotient, to understand what makes people tick. Now, these are some qualities that also apply in the corporate and other professions. So there are some similarities there. But you know, as I said, there are some similarities and there are some differences. Another difference I'd like to point out is that although in corporate worlds you do have cliques and you have groups and you have corporate politics, but essentially loyalty cannot trump competence beyond a certain point. If a corporate chieftain were to only have loyalists and not care about competence, it's going to come to grief pretty quickly. Whereas in politics, competence is often sacrificed in favor of loyalty, and that doesn't seem to cost as much in the short term, because politics is so much about personalities and so much about branding of an individual or a party, that even short-term lack of competence down the chain of command may not make a dent. It'll make a dent in the long term for sure.
The feedback loop is also much longer in a political context.
Right? You're absolutely right.
Got it. And the other thing I'm curious about often is in professions, if there are markers of long-term potential. You know, there's this interesting dialogue in this movie called Deewar, Lambe Race Ka Ghoda, you know, where he looks at a kid on the street and says, you know, he'll be a big man one day. Are there markers of long-term potential when you look at a budding politician? Are there one or two things you look for you to say this person could have an impactful career over the long term?
Yes and no. Many high-potential politicians have been felled by circumstances. So I would point this out, that circumstances have a much greater role to play in politics than they do in other professions. In other professions too, of course, circumstances matter. But one can adapt to them and change much more than one can in politics. So I've seen many a high potential, high profile politician fail because he or she was just felled by circumstances. Now, to overcome that, you've seen politicians who are very agile in their stands, in what they espouse, not strictly on ideology, but on what sells for the time being. So let me use this as an example in the world of music. If you are a classical musician and you prefer to play your the kind of music that you've always loved, now if that's in fashion, you'll do very well. If the public wants a different kind of music, you may be out of it. But there are musicians we all know who may have started out in the era of rock and roll and changed to more pop kind of music and then changed to rap, depending on what the public wants. And some people are capable of flipping genres or stepping across genres. So the really long-term Lambi Race Ka Ghoda in politics are those who are able to step across genres better than others.
And genres would be public sentiment? I mean, just translating that metaphor to the political context.
So the public sentiment can keep changing. Today, you might be appealing to the youth. Tomorrow, you may have to appeal to certain subsections of the population, depending on the state you are contesting an election in or managing a campaign. Sometimes you might have to appeal to women's issues, and so on and so forth. So another aspect is the ability to communicate, obviously. In politics, the ability to communicate is a tremendous asset.
Got it.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Just a quick comment. This segment of my conversation with Jay reminds me of an earlier chat with Nandan Nilekani, when he spoke about his various transitions and how he's reinvented himself across different contexts. He shares why he contested the elections in Bangalore and then subsequently why he moved away from politics.
It was an intellectual choice actually, mm-hmm. to get into politics, but my experience was not very happy. And in that sense, I think that was one transition where I stepped too far in some sense. It was way outside my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. So I, after the election campaign and after that, I realized that this was not where I want to be. That I didn't have the leverage. I didn't have competitive advantage in that area. I didn't think I would be very effective. Hmm. So I realized that actually my effectiveness comes from being what I'm good at, which is a technology-led transformation agent, and use my talents and abilities to solve large, intractable problems and make that available to anybody who wants to use it. So that was my shift.
I guess it's worth reflecting whether your source of energy and distinctive competitive advantage aligns with the traits and attributes that are valued in the field you're getting into. Just a quick note on how you could access the content of the podcast. You could get it at iTunes, Stitcher, Savan, or any of the other places where you normally get your podcast. But that may not allow you to navigate across speakers by theme. If you want to do that, you could go to playtopotential.com and navigate through any of the tags along which the content is organized. If you find the conversation purposeful, do rate and review on iTunes. It will help others discover the podcast and seek value from it. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Jay.
And just double-clicking on one of the things you mentioned, Jay, resilience and perseverance. What do the, and thick skin, what do the bad days look like?
See, if you are my kind of politician who has got into politics for not the usual reasons, for a different set of reasons, then there are quite a few bad days because you see the system operating the way it always does, disruptions in parliament, people looking for short-term gain, which may not be in the national interest. So these are, you can take them as demoralizing. But if you have a resolute approach to going through thick and thin, then you look for the good days. So on a bad day, for example, a bad day can be that I've been arguing for certain reforms and suddenly I'll get attacked for saying the exact same thing because some other party has said the same thing. So, for example, I've been arguing for reforming the Rajya Sabha for a decade. Suddenly, this government has also started arguing for reforming the Rajya Sabha. And people in the opposition suddenly start throwing mud at me that I'm collaborating with the government and not recognizing that I have been taking this stand on principle, irrespective of who is in government. So bad days can be getting attacked for really no fault of your own, and that happens quite a lot. But the good days can be when one of your ideas begins to take hold, and then you get acknowledged as being an early promoter of the idea. So, for example, I had been supporting the idea that convicted legislators should lose their position, either as an MP or an MLA. They should get disqualified if they get convicted. Now, there was tremendous resistance to this idea inside politics. Certainly inside parliament, there was no consensus that convicted MPs should get disqualified. But I championed that idea, and I did face a lot of heat. But then Supreme Court finally ruled on this, and it is now a law. It is now the law of the land that if you get convicted, you immediately lose your position as an MP or an MLA. And so many people in the public recognized that I had championed this idea earlier. So this is a big idea. Let me give you a small idea. One of the small ideas I had championed and faced a lot of flack was that the subsidy in the parliament canteen should be done away with. Because on the one hand, we were asking for millions of Indian citizens, especially in middle class categories, to give up government subsidies, such as on cooking gas, and asking them to pay market prices for petrol and things like that. And at the same time, for legislators to get subsidized food was unconscionable. But I faced a lot of flack, not just by legislators, but by many journalists who also avail of these facilities in the parliament canteen. But the public support was enormous, and ultimately parliament had to make changes and do away with a large component of the subsidy in the parliament canteen. So although I had to face flak, I get gratified by the large numbers of members of the public who stop me at airports and at other places and compliment me for taking certain stands such as that one. So those are the good days.
Got it. I want to go back to the transition from Rajya Sabha to Lok Sabha. How did you think about the two options? And how should people think about participating in the Rajya Sabha versus Lok Sabha? What are the trade-offs?
So my entry into politics had been somewhat accidental, not entirely, but it was not one big decision. It was a series of decisions. As you know, I was in the corporate world, and in the 90s, I was involved in industry associations. And I used to often point out all the ills of the system, the red tape, the corruption, the illogical, irrational, inverted taxes at certain places. One thing led to another, and I got involved in the founding of a new political party. Now, this is not the usual way of getting into politics, but it led to my coming into the Rajya Sabha. Now, even that was not a full-fledged entry into politics. It happened over the next few years that I got more and more involved. Then after a couple of years, I served as the leader of my party in the Rajya Sabha, handling many other day-to-day responsibilities. And then I realized that if I were to be, in fact, full-time in politics, which I had already become, then the Lok Sabha was the right place, because the Lok Sabha is a direct election. You have a direct mandate from the people. So in other words, it has more street cred, if you will. And certainly in a parliamentary system, the government of the day depends on having a majority in the Lok Sabha, but not necessarily a majority in the Rajya Sabha. So in that sense, the Lok Sabha is that much more critical to the system. So if you are to be in full-fledged politics, then of course the Lok Sabha has a slight edge over the Rajya Sabha. That doesn't mean the Rajya Sabha is not important. It is. I have never argued for doing away with the Rajya Sabha, only to reform it. And similarly, being an MLA also is a full-fledged aspect of being in politics. So if you're to be in really hardcore, full-fledged politics, I would strongly advocate getting to the roots of it, which is to have a people's mandate. But the Rajya Sabha has its own advantages. It frees you up from having to go and spend time in the constituency. I spend, you know, at least half the year, half the month, every month in the constituency. And that has a different aspect to it, away from the policy-making discussions and decisions and debates at a national level. So the Rajya Sabha does have its own advantages.
Got it. And therefore, does it, I'm curious, it's almost like a 2x2, right? One is sort of Rajya Sabha versus Lok Sabha, the other is state versus center. Again, if you look at the kind of people that end up flourishing in one versus the other, are there systematic patterns that emerge?
Yes, but there is an overlap. Please recognize that many people who are MPs started out by being MLAs. Many people who are in national politics started out by being in state politics. So there is an overlap. But there is a distinction between the two as well. Obviously, at the state level, you are mostly grappling with local issues. Whereas at the national level, you are required to grapple with national and international issues. So there's much more of a scope to be involved in policy making, in foreign policy, in fiscal policy, in health and agriculture policy. That doesn't mean that you are totally divorced from the local realities. Because let me tell you, as a Lok Sabha member representing nearly 2 million people, see, every Lok Sabha constituency in India is the size of a small European country. Think of every Lok Sabha constituency as being akin to an Estonia or a Slovenia in terms of population and sometimes even in terms of geographical size. And yet, a member of parliament doesn't have any we're near the kind of authority or power to resolve many of the issues. So when we spend time in the constituency, the discussion there is entirely different from the discussion in Delhi. In the local constituency, your voters are not very bothered about what is happening with Pakistan and what is happening with China or the fiscal deficit or the income tax rate. They're mostly bothered about getting drinking water, getting access to hospitals and good, better schooling, and most essentially jobs, but you know, things like that, better roads. So that's a very different kind of discussion. And as a member of parliament, one uses whatever authority one has. We don't have executive authority really, but we have certain moral authority and certain political clout. and use that to try and make those things happen. Whereas technically, we are supposed to be representing legislative issues in parliament, but both are equally important.
Got it. And I want to move to a different theme, which is about being effective in politics. The one theme I'm curious about is how people stay relevant in a profession over decades. When you look at politics, how do you think about staying relevant as a politician over decades? And what have some of the successful politicians done? And you spoke about the music metaphor, but let's expand on that a little bit on how you stay relevant.
So I have asked this question of many senior politicians, and I think somebody who has been a chief minister many times, has been a cabinet minister many times, told me an interesting aspect. So his way of staying relevant was to have done so much for his constituency that he wouldn't even have to campaign to win. This is a person who won in a particular constituency multiple times. And all that hard work that he put in decades ago means that he has, if you will, a pocket borough. So one method of this is a key method of remaining relevant is to always ensure that you're in parliament. If you're not in parliament, then your relevance, of course, decreases. So this is one way to ensure relevance is to create such a situation back home in your constituency that you will always or almost always come back re-elected into parliament and parties can't ignore you. So that's one key aspect. And I've taken this to heart and tried to follow it myself. There are others who have found ways to remain relevant. They have catered to niches or subsections of the polity and appeal to their concerns in a way that larger parties or other politicians have not. So they have become champions of certain groups or subsections of the population, and that has kept them relevant. There are many other ways of staying relevant. People who are glib and can communicate very well can remain relevant irrespective of changes of leadership, irrespective of changes of government. Another way to stay relevant is to be loyal to somebody else who has a certain entrenched position and will always be around. So that has been a way of staying relevant. There are many different ways.
Got it. And in what ways has technology changed the game compared to what it was 20 years back, both in terms of staying relevant, but also in terms of the various elements of politics, including building a personal brand?
Technology is beginning to have a huge impact, but it has really only started impacting Indian politics in the last decade, and especially in the last 5 years. So I'm fond of using an example. You know, one of the reasons that we have many dynastic politicians is that if you come from a political family, there is a certain branding already associated with you. And this is corroborated by studies and books which say that people expect you to stand for something if you are from a particular family with a certain surname. But even at least equally important, or maybe even more important, is that if you come from a political family, you have a generations-old network to mobilize for you. People who will organize crowds for you, people who will mobilize the voters to go to the booth on voting day, people who will put up your posters and banners. And so that ground network had been very crucial. Now, both of these are getting upended by technology. And as I said, especially in the last 5 years. Now, starting about 10 years ago, we started seeing the use of telecom technology with bulk SMSs and bulk voice messages going out from leaders to millions of voters. Subsequently, in the last 5 years or so, social media has begun catching the imagination, as many hundreds of millions of Indians get on the internet, and many of them are on social media and other instant messaging platforms. We have already seen many examples of first generation politicians creating a brand for themselves and creating mobilization of their message and of their voters through social media and through instant messaging platforms. So to that extent, the ground has been leveled, that your family name and your family networks are no longer such a huge advantage as they used to be. And the use of technology has, as I said, leveled the playing field.
Okay. And back to the point about thick skin and perseverance and resilience, how do you see technology playing out in the context of all the discussions in terms of fake news and the ease with which it's easy to manipulate people's minds? How is that playing out?
So here, there are two sides of the coin. We have had a world where information was curated, where what is news was decided by a limited number of editors and reporters. So a few thousand people decided what hundreds of millions of people should view or read. That has got completely rent asunder by social media. On social media and using technology, everybody is a reporter. Everybody is an editor. So it has gone from the paradigm of one to many to a new paradigm of many to many. And so that curating of news has been destroyed, and many people are objecting to that. That I don't agree is a valid objection. You know, the curators of news, whether they be editors or whether they be reporters or whether they be opinion makers or politicians or others who were able to add weightage to a certain viewpoint, this democratization of news has totally destroyed that. There is fake news, but equally, we have to recognize that fake news is not from any one side. Sometimes it gets projected as if fake news is coming from one side of the political spectrum. That's not true. There is fake news, there is trolling from all across the political spectrum. It has a darker side to it. It inflames passions. It sometimes targets certain sections of the community. And it creates all kinds of new issues that uncurated information will create. Now, I believe it's a phase that will transition as follows. Now, recently, just last week, Twitter has announced certain steps so that the use of bots to retweet and create trends of certain news, which a large number of bots are tweeting, will be curtailed to some extent. Now, Facebook has been facing similar allegations, and they have also started taking steps to put filters on this kind of effort. Now, fake news used to be somebody planting a conspiracy theory or a totally fake document. Recently, there have been revelations about IRA in Russia doing that in the US elections and in other countries' elections. Now, I believe the answer to fake news is not to try and curtail social media, but to have even more transparency. As social media develops further, as it becomes ubiquitous, I think there will emerge more trusted sources of news, more verifiable sources of news. And it's a process. So I'm very much against the idea of restraining any kind of opinion, of course, with one proviso, that social media should not give you the right to threaten people any more than you can threaten people in real life. Mm. So intimidation, threats of violence, publishing your address so that people can create trouble for you. These are things that, you know, a right to privacy should be translated into a law. And by the way, I have filed the first right to privacy law in Parliament as a private member's bill. But besides a certain narrowly defined set of red lines, no-nos of intimidation, threats, etc., opinions should not be restricted.
I hear you. And picking up a different theme, Jay, when I look at leadership development, again, when I sort of take the business world paradigm and look at how it works in the political context, again, as you reflect on yourself, in what ways would you say you've grown as a leader? What are the muscles you've built today that probably didn't exist when you started with the Rajya Sabha in 2000 or when you joined the Lok Sabha in 2009? How does that growth work?
So I think it works differently for different people. I believe I've done the following. Now, even as a student, even as a professional in the private sector, I was always interested in global issues. I used to read newspapers and magazines from around the world. But my depth on some of those issues has grown a lot. So I spend a large amount of time on a few issues of my, which are I consider passions of mine. These have to do with economic issues. These have to do with policies concerning health and education and foreign policy. So for example, on foreign policy, I'm involved in quite a number of track two dialogues, and I chair many of these discussions with the US, in South Korea, Japan, etc. And as a result, my depth on foreign policy, my understanding of nuances of where India is and where it ought to be, and what are the foreign policy steps we ought to take to face these challenges, is better and more nuanced. So that's a muscle that I have built. I have a better understanding of economics than I did 15 years ago, although I did have a pretty solid understanding of economics and commerce and trade coming from the private sector, but a much better understanding. For example, on one of these track two discussions, I had a detailed discussion with one of the sovereign credit rating agencies. One of the Moody's and Standard and Poor's and all of that. And it helped me to understand why the fiscal deficit is so important. Why is this so crucial? Because that's the single most important parameter that these ratings agencies choose to base their ratings of a country. There are many other factors, but sure. The deficit is perhaps the single biggest weightage in that.
And just to understand the language, Jay, when you say track two, could you expand on that for a minute?
So a track two is a group of people involved in policy making. It could be members of parliament, other politicians. It could be diplomats, especially retired diplomats, and people from the armed forces, people from business, people from journalism, civil society organizations, who interact in meetings and on visits to other countries, where this is not an official group. We don't represent the government of our country. But we all have some kind of connection with policymakers to give feedback and ideas and suggestions, and can have free and frank discussions between our counterparts and us. The reason is when governments meet, officially they have a lot of constraints within which to take positions. And it's very difficult to come out with out-of-the-box solutions. Out-of-the-box solutions always come in back-channel discussions first. So it's a sort of a informal back channel to help create out-of-the-box ideas.
Interesting.
Another area where I've built muscle, you asked that question, is in with my transition to Lok Sabha nearly a decade ago, and with my spending nearly 2 weeks of the month, every month in the constituency, I have built a branding in my constituency. I have put in a lot of sweat into building my connect with a couple of million people. So a certain branding and a certain mind share, if you will, or mind space, if you will, among a couple of million voters is a muscle that I've built.
And just picking up on this, Jay, I'm curious about how leaders think about micro and macro. In this case, you spoke about track two, where you're talking to international delegations and think tanks. And you're talking to people in your constituency. How do you sort of manage this bird's eye view and the worm's eye view?
So there has to be some compartmentalization, but also with an overlap. Now, if any elected representative, including me, were to get bored of dealing with the mundane problems of his constituents, then he's not going to last for very long. And fortunately, not only I don't get bored, I enjoy meeting my constituents. If you or your listeners have gone to my social media pages, you will see that I spend enormous amounts of time with my constituents and I post about it all the time. And some of my friends have told me that I, despite the heat and dust and the sweat that goes into this, I seem to be enjoying myself. And yes, I do. I actually enjoy meeting thousands of people every day and listening to their issues and discussing with them what's important to them, which are mostly always local issues, and trying my best to help them. Now, I don't always succeed, but to the extent that I do succeed, people recognize that I'm trying, And even if it doesn't quite work out, they realize that I'm sincerely trying for them. And so that is a very important aspect. There are some politicians who feel that that aspect of it is a burden. Then it can become a huge burden because that's essential to getting reelected. Fortunately, I don't feel it a burden. I enjoy that. Now, when I am in Delhi in Parliament or in some international forum talking about policy issues, it is mostly a different set of issues, but not to say that there isn't any overlap. So, for example, let's say I'm talking climate change. Now, it's a very macro issue. You would imagine that there's not that much connect to the local concerns of my constituents. And almost never is there any climate change issue discussed in the constituency. But I'll tell you how it's relevant. So we still have large numbers of people in India who don't have electricity. And they don't care how they get it, whether they get it from fossil fuels or whether they get it from solar energy. They want it yesterday and they want it cheap. Now, solar energy is only now becoming cost effective, and alternative energy sources are only now just beginning to become cost effective, just in the last couple of years. So if we were to have a climate change discussion and forswear the use of fossil fuels, it wouldn't be a very practical discussion in the context of hundreds of millions of people not having electricity. You can try to build a bridge to the future, which is having a less carbon footprint, but you can't ignore the pressures of the present. And finding a solution to the present with a bridge to the future is a challenge that politicians must face when grappling with climate change.
Got it. And moving forward, Jay, if you reflect on, let's say, the three pieces of advice or feedback that you've received over the years that have really helped you become a better politician, what stands out for you?
This is going to sound not very highfalutin, but the advice I've received that have proved to be most useful are very basic. One was to never take people at face value. Some of us who come from professional backgrounds tend to think that if a person says something, he or she means it, or that it must be accurate. In politics, you learn to always take everything with a pinch of salt, unless you have other corroborating factors. The other bit of advice I've received was to never speak your mind unless you were sure that it was the right thing to do. Because unlike in many other professions, speaking your mind can have detrimental effects. Now, this is a bit of advice I've not been able to follow very much because I'm known for being candid and speaking my mind. The third thing, one advice that has been very useful to me is to always keep the people in mind. Now, in politics, you come across many intermediaries. You come across your local party office bearers. You come across local leaders who have their own interests, their own stakes, which may or may not always be aligned with voters. So one of the lessons I learned early on is if you align your interest with voters' interest. So one example of aligning to the voters has to do with the MP LAD funds. These are the MP's local area developmental funds. And there is immense pressure from local party officials to sanction them for small projects which they themselves can bid for and build and in the process benefit from. And you don't see many remaining effects of the expenditure. Whereas the better thing to do, which I have done, is to ask the population in general rather than local party leaders. And so one of the examples is that they wanted drinking water facilities, which are larger projects. Each of them are about 30 lakhs, 28 to 30 lakhs of rupees instead of 2-3 lakhs of rupees. Now, this doesn't benefit your local party workers very much, but it benefits the population a lot. And this is one of the reasons I believe that I've been able to build a branding as somebody who cares for the people's problems rather than political workers. It's not easy to do because you need your political workers' support also to do your grassroots campaigning and mobilization. But this is where technology helps, as I was explaining earlier, that even without those physical networks today, you can do your mobilization on the ground using technology. So being aligned to voters and their true concerns rather than the concerns of party workers is another good advice.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Just a quick observation. This segment of my conversation with Jay reminds me of an earlier chat with Suresh Narayanan, MD of Nestle India Limited. While a big chunk of the conversation was around how he navigated the ship after the Maggi crisis, he also spoke about how he transitioned effectively across various markets when he moved from Egypt to Singapore, Thailand, Philippines and India.
Especially at senior management levels, it is important to step back and observe. So what I used to do in all the new situations is, I always walk around. I don't sit in my chair. I walk around the office. I walk around to the sites. I walk around where, talk to the common people. What are the kinds of things that interest you? What are the kind of things that bothers you? What suggestion would you give to make this company better? Right? I think there are ways in which you touch the lives of people. The minute you touch the lives of people, you as a leader do not become unreachable anymore.
As a CEO or as a political leader, I guess it's critical that one finds a mechanism of discerning the pulse of the people on the ground, whether it's your consumer or your supporter. Just a quick note on how you could access the content of the podcast. You could get it at iTunes, Stitcher, Savan, or any of the other places where you normally get your podcast, but that may not allow you to navigate across speakers by theme. If you want to do that, you could go to playtopotential.com and navigate through any of the tags along which the content is organized. If you find the conversation purposeful, do rate and review on iTunes. It will help other people discover the podcast and possibly seek value from it. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Jay.
And since you mentioned, Jay, when you look at the multiple things that land on your table that require attention and require resources, how do you prioritize? How do you think about impact? Is there a sort of certain set of criteria you have that sort of...
This is a great question, because we have a fundamental problem. This goes back to the first question you asked and I answered about the remnants of the British Raj parliamentary system, where I said that we have many reforms to implement. So one example is, we are probably the only parliament in the world which does not provide for office and staff for members of parliament. Now, every other parliament, whether you go to the US Senate or Congress or the UK Parliament in Australia, Canada, members of parliament are treated as professionals in their own field. They get an office, they get a staff. Now, in India, we don't. We get many perks, but just a pittance for having an office and staff. We can barely have a telephone operator, let alone a team of researchers or assistants, which you need. Every day, we literally get hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of documents. We get hundreds of reports, all running into many thousands of pages. It is very hard to keep up with all that unless you have assistance. So, besides campaigning for that reform, I have been taking advantage of certain facilities that are available, such as there are now volunteers who intern at a political office for getting experience, but they are lawyers, they are young professionals, and they are able to assist with dealing with vast information that lands on our table every day. Plus, there are organizations that have come up, such as PRS Legislative, such as Swaniti and others, who have got funded projects for providing fellowships. These are like internships, but they are paid for, again, young professionals. They could be engineers or lawyers or social workers, management people who take time off and spend a few months or a year or so working in a politician's office or a political party. So this helps. Now, in terms of prioritizing, apart from information, the overload of information, one always has to prioritize any crisis. And sadly, we have many crises. Now, I have crises in the constituency. So, for example, very often in the summer months, we have fires. And since we still have a large number of thatched huts with lakhs of population, every time there's a fire, many families lose their belongings, everything that they have. So I have to reprioritize my schedule and make sure I reach there and make sure that the governmental assistance and assistance from charities and others are mobilized so that they can get their lives back in order. Now, this may not sound like a legislative priority for an elected legislator, but if I'm not there to stand with my constituents in their time of trouble, then I wouldn't be a legislator. They wouldn't, necessarily vote for me. Similarly, in Parliament, priorities keep changing all the time. It's not something that has a very rigid schedule. So you have to roll with the punches, as they say.
Got it. Just moving on to a different theme, Jay, around what the world of business can learn from the world of politics. One of the pieces I'm curious about is this tightrope between being decisive and being democratic. And leaders often need to balance the two. And especially in the digital world that's emerging around us, there's a lot of discourse around rapid decision-making, break things and fail fast kind of way of life. How do you think about the tightrope? And more specifically, how can the business world learn from the wisdom of the political world?
Well, I generally believe that in any profession, you can learn from other professions. But here, there is a fundamental difference. This idea of risk-taking is relatively alien in politics. Politics is about avoiding failure, about avoiding slip-ups and falling down, largely. It's not that no one takes risks, but those are rare. Whereas a successful business, particularly an innovative tech business, might follow the precepts that you mentioned, fail fast and move on. In politics, it's avoiding failure that becomes more of a priority. I've noticed, whereas in businesses, most businesses urge their people to be decisive, to take decisions as quickly as practically possible. In politics, I've noticed that most decisions are delayed to as late as until you can no longer avoid taking that decision for fear of making a mistake. And one of the reasons is politics is about popularity and businesses are not. Now, you can have businesses that are unpopular with people but are very successful because they deliver a product or a service or an innovative idea very efficiently. Whereas in politics, it's hard to sustain if you lose popularity. So these are issues that are quite different. I wish politics learned a bit more from business, a bit more risk-taking. And I wish businesses learned a bit more about, politicians can be very good at adapting to circumstances and very good at communicating why they have changed or adapted. So these are lessons that I think other professions can learn from.
And one of the skills that I think clearly politicians have in abundance is this notion of influencing an ecosystem, right? When you have an idea, for example, you spoke about moving from an idea around legislation around people who have a criminal background,
To
get disqualified. Again, in business, clearly a lot more is getting done through the, interconnectedness of the ecosystems, right? Much more than before. Earlier, one could argue the business value chain was relatively linear. Now it looks a lot more enmeshed. So talk to us a little bit about how you think about influencing. Maybe if you take a specific example, how does an idea move from something in your head to something that's legislated?
Well, that idea about disqualifying convicted legislators didn't happen through the sphere of politics. Even though I championed it and one or two others did, it did not get traction. But it was a Supreme Court ruling that made it happen. So it was an externality in that sense. We have many other such examples where the legislators and parliament have let the country down. Go back 20 years when the courts again imposed natural gas for public transportation in Delhi. It should have been a political decision, an administrative decision because of the pollution that we were facing. But even today, after much more pollution, we are still struggling to take administrative decisions because of populism, because of trying to pander to every section of society. And that's a fact of the particular kind of political structure that we have. Whereas in many other countries, even if you don't have everybody on board, but you have a kind of majority on board, then you can push through political ideas. That again is related to the idea of reforming our political structures, our parliament, and how decision making happens. But to take an idea and spin it and to get it to get traction, communication skills are extremely important. And also it is important to suss out the public mood and try to latch on to an idea which is ripe, because advocating an idea that is far ahead of its time is not going to get that much traction. But advocating an idea that is only slightly ahead of its time may be the right way of doing it, because then the public may be just about getting ready for it, and you're advocating it or communicating competently about it then takes it over that hurdle, and it gets huge traction.
And how do you get that pulse?
Now that is a critical political skill, to be able to have feedback. Now you'll notice every time you ask a politician of any party, they'll always say they're doing very well. They'll never say they're doing badly, or very rarely will they say they're doing badly. Particularly at any election campaign, you ask the spokespersons of any party and they'll all claim they're winning. Now that's an external face. But internally, the good politicians have a very good grasp of where they stand. I have seen this among the most successful politicians. They may externally be saying anything, but internally, they have a very clear grasp of reality. And they know pretty much how they are doing, whether they're doing well or badly, or well in certain areas and badly in certain areas. So that feedback loop has to be very good if you are to succeed in politics.
And what is it about the channels that you need to have in place to have an objective and an effective feedback loop?
So that's also a great question, because we earlier talked about how politics rewards loyalty above all else, above competence. So you have a lot of sycophants in politics, and some parties more than others, but yes, you do. So sycophants are never going to always give you the right information. They'll give you information that you want to hear. You must have your own system of bypassing that. So I find that even politicians who are surrounded by a lot of sycophants, some of them do recognize that, you know, they have that ecosystem just because they need loyalists to entrench their hold on power. But they don't rely on them for getting the feedback loop. They get the feedback loop from other sources. And if you don't, then you are doomed to do badly in the next cycle.
And other sources would be things like?
It could be journalists. It could be people on the ground that you know. It could be somebody several levels lower down on the chain of command whom you directly speak to. So, for example, I'll make it a point, because I meet with so many thousands of people in the constituency, and I have an open channel. People can send me messages on instant messaging platforms and on social media. So I get a sense for what people are talking about. And if I get a message or a series of messages that runs counter to what my closest people are telling me, then I will cross-check and I will try to have it vetted as to what the reality is. What are people really saying? What are people really thinking? What is the factual condition, situation?
Got it. And just as we move towards wrapping up, Jay, how do you think about excellence in the context of politics? As you look at politicians that have inspired you, what about them, what about some of these leaders make them great and not just good?
Well, look, ultimately politics is about improving the lot of people, improving the conditions of our voters and our country. Now, not all politicians work like that. Many of them work only for their own benefit rather than for the national benefit. But there are many examples of politicians who have done the right thing. So take the example of P.V. Narasimha Rao. He spent decades being an apparatchik of a particular party. and an odd set of circumstances suddenly pitchforked him into the prime ministership, and he inherited a huge crisis where India was about to default on its external payments. He used the crisis superbly to bring in reforms which either had been not thought about or even had been thought about were not implemented by earlier leaders. So that was a fantastic thing that he did, and you can see the results of that even quarter century later. That was a turning point. Take the example of Vajpayee, another political leader who spent decades out of office and only got a few years at the end of his career as prime minister. He shifted the gears very dramatically on a particular aspect which meets this question of yours. Indian politics had always been, from independence, very populist, because we went from British Raj, where the public's opinion didn't matter, to suddenly public opinion mattering even when the country was 75% illiterate and 75% poor. And so populism was the call of the day for many decades, investing in handouts rather than on long-term investments. Vajpayee shifted the needle dramatically when he started this massive infrastructure program, twofold. One was the Golden Quadrilateral, highways connecting the entire nation. And the second was the PMGSY, Pradhan Mantri Gram Sadak Yojana, building asphalt roads into villages. So today, more than 90% of all Indian villages have asphalt roads, which has transformed their lives. Because just to take an example in Odisha, during the monsoons, for 3 to 4 months every year, large sections of the population used to be cut off from civilization because everything around them was mud. They couldn't go to the local school. They couldn't go to the local hospital. They couldn't go to the market 10 kilometers away. Now, Vajpayee shifted the needle by taking a bold gambit. It didn't pay off immediately, but if you look 20 years later, it has paid off hugely. For anybody that spends time in rural India, you can recognize it. More recently, the GST. Now, the GST creates a unified market. Although many people have advocated it, Manmohan Singh when he was prime minister and others, but it was under the Modi government that it happened. And it took enormous grit and enormous commitment to make it happen. It didn't happen on autopilot. It required a lot of cajoling and twisting of arms. So that is an example of using political capital to bring about a seismic shift. With all the difficulties of implementing GST and the initial hurdles will pale in the future when you look at the benefits that it brings about. Because for the first time, India becomes a unified domestic market. In the US, it happened again many decades after their independence when they passed the Interstate Commerce Act. And this removes a lot of peculiar inversions in our economy. When we don't have a unified market, which we didn't until now, it used to be cheaper to send raw materials abroad to get it processed into finished goods and then re-import it back. Whereas the value addition was going elsewhere, the profits were going elsewhere. We were just consumers. That inversion gets dramatically rectified. So these are three examples of leaders using either political capital or a crisis or a particular window of opportunity to shift gears in a very dramatic fashion.
Got it. Lovely, Jay. Again, in summary, this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals playing to their individual potential, both in terms of the choices they make and in terms of how they grow. In summary, any parting thoughts for the listeners in terms of how they can play to their potential?
Well, before that, I'd like to say one thing, that we often diss politics and politicians, and for good reason, because we see all the warts. But we should recognize that democracy is something that billions of people aspire for. So we must first cherish the fact that we have a democracy, first of all, and then grapple with its shortcomings and try to improve them. Sometimes we fall into the pattern of thinking, oh, maybe democracy is the problem. It is not. Democracy is the solution, but it is a necessary but not yet a sufficient condition because it needs further improvements. Now, as far as people playing to their potential, I would again reiterate what we started out with. you can improve the country, you can improve the world dramatically, no matter whichever field you're in. You can be in business, in science, in art. You can be a social worker. You can be a doctor. You can be anything. You can be, of course, a politician also. I would like to say that to play to your potential, you must, and this is an old adage, everybody knows it, do things that you enjoy doing which matter. Now, I said one of the requirements of a politician is to spend a lot of time with constituents, and some people do it as a burden. Others do it because they love being with people. And you can see the difference in terms of the support that they get, the branding that they build. Similarly, do find your passion and pursue it. It's much easier to succeed that way.
Jay, pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you. Thank you, Deepak.
Hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. There were three big takeaways for me here. First, each career path has a unique characteristic or a trait that I find worthwhile unearthing. For instance, accomplished lawyer and entrepreneur Zia Modi spoke about attention to detail as something that's a critical trait that every lawyer must aspire to have. It was interesting to have Jay talk about resilience and agility as a key traits in the context of staying relevant as a politician. Second, the track two dialogues that Jay spoke about. I think that's something the business world could learn from, the world of politics. Very often, in business negotiations, say between an investor and a company, people take positions and it can be hard to shake that view. How do we configure and simulate a track two dialogue where each other's point of view is well understood and out-of-the-box solutions are thought about is indeed an interesting thought to mull over. One thought here is that maybe this is an opportunity for high potentials in each organization to engage and understand the context better and co-create possible solutions. Third is the point around setting up informal feedback loops. Several leaders in the corporate world struggle to do this. And the key point here is that you need to do this without disempowering your chain of command. Several leaders take a black and white approach to say, I don't want my team to feel that I'm interfering in their business and therefore do not reach down to the people down the chain. But the tactful ones find an informal way of tapping into the sentiment of the people across the chain without really challenging the authority of the team members. Thank you for listening. If you find the content purposeful, please share with those that you think would find this valuable. And do take a moment to rate and review on iTunes. For more content from leaders like Nandan Nilekani, Zia Modi, Vinita Bali, Vishy Anand, Atul Kasbekar, Amish Tripathi and more, do visit playtopotential.com. You could access a full conversation or access content that's curated by key themes that might be of interest to you. My next guest is Amit Chandra, MD of Bain Capital India. And we talk about his journey as a banker, the transition to investing, his perspectives on philanthropy and social impact, and more. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast. Signing off for now is Deepak Jayaraman. And to know more about what I do, please visit transitioninsight.com. Bye now.